right, everybody, happy Thursday, December 17th, 2015. I've had quite a few people ask me, where they can find a page with all of my shows available to download. I wasn't sure that there was one, for podcasts. It turns out there is one. It's here it is. For the podcast, it's blogtalkradio.com/truthhurtsradio/podcast. A lot of people like to listen in with their phones. I think you can download it, but you can just listen too, on your devices. And then there's the regular blogtalkradio.com/truthhurtsradio. It's the same website. You just put a slash podcast at the end. And then, of course, there's Renegades Archives, renegadebroadcasting.com/Charles-Giuliani/. If you didn't get that, just email me and I'll send all three pages to you. But they do exist. There are pages that do exist where my shows are available all together. It's sad, unless you have these actual web pages available, it's not always so easily, it's not always so easy to find. Blog Talk is not a website that is, browser friendly. It's just chaos. But anyway, those are the websites to check out. Like I said, just email me if you want them, and I'll send them to you. And once again, the email address to do that is truthhurtsradio@aol.com. Spell Hertz like megahertz, H-E-R-T-Z. All right, guys, let's pick up where we left off yesterday, talking about Mr. FDR here. We were mentioning all of his cabinet members and non-cabinet members as well, who were highly influential on him. Every freaking one of them. I mean, he had a serious infestation problem. But it wasn't just that his administration was saturated with tribe members. He was one himself. And, he had tribal connections on both sides, the Rosenfeld, or Roosevelt, I should say, which was really, the real name was Rosenvelt. But anyway, also on the Delano side, as far as the Roosevelt name goes, originally, yes, it was Rosenvelt, going back to at least the 17th century. His family line can be traced on the Roosevelt side. They first came to America in 1682, having originally been Sephardic Jews who fled from Spain in 1492. Quite a few families had done this at that time. And quite a few of them, of course, changed their name to hide their, just like Roosevelt, to hide their Jewish origins. And a lot of them wound up, coming here. They got the Brits to establish colonies here so that they could continue with their little game playing, which is why, New York was originally named New Amsterfreakingdam. Goddamn. Amsterdam, don't forget, was their major banking haven for centuries. And now, you know, by calling New York that, you know what their intentions were from the frickin' word go. Later, it became a little too obvious, so they changed it. But anyway, Roosevelt actually admitted his Jewish lineage to the New York Times in the March 14th, 1935 edition, where he was quoted as saying, "In the distant past, my ancestors may have been Jews, and may have. All I know about the origin of the Roosevelt family is that they were apparently descendants of Claes Mortensen van Roosevelt." So there you go. He knew damn freaking well what his ancestry was. He knew it all too well. He's playing dumb. "We may have been." Roosevelt served his little Jewish community very well, of course. On May 8th, 1937, the New York Herald Tribune featured an article which was later carried nationwide by the Associated Press. And it stated that, quote, "President Roosevelt will receive the 10th award of the Gothiel Medal for distinguished service to Jewry." Imagine. So, you know, what more proof than that do you need? He was a tribe member through and freaking through for his service to Jewry. That's all our presidents have been doing all along, isn't it, ladies and gentlemen? Serving Jewry. They certainly aren't serving us. God damn it, in case you haven't noticed. The medal featured Roosevelt's head on one side and the six-pointed star on the other, with a mystical good luck idiom in the center of the star. Oh, they've had a lot of good luck, haven't they? Even if he wasn't a tribe member, they'd still would have had good luck with him, wouldn't they? Because, of course, they like to wave big fat wads of ill-gotten, illegitimate cash around to buy off political puppets. And they always see to it that it works out to their advantage beyond mere finances that they wave at them. You know, they have the promise of guaranteeing to live another day if they comply with their demands. The awarding of the medal included a card bearing these words on the inside: "Good luck and wisdom to Franklin D. Roosevelt, our modern Moses, leading Jewry in the promised land under the seal of Solomon." Jesus Christ. Does it get any more obvious than that who precisely he was? Oh, and he did indeed lead Judaism in the promised land, didn't he? His whole administration was a tribal coup, ladies and gentlemen. Never in history had the Jews hijacked and raped the nation on the scale that they did, at least up to that point. You know, under FDR, up to that time. Never in all of history. Anyway. And it's been downhill ever since. But how clueless America is, they have no idea who's calling the shots, even though, my God, it's so obvious. It's the elephant in the freaking living room. No idea what their politicians are up to, who they work for, who's really calling the shots. And worse yet, when you try to tell them, holy Christ, you might as well wear a freaking bullseye on your goddamn shirt. People will attack you. A friend of mine who moved to Florida about a year ago met a girl down there and shared with her, you know, one of my shows to listen to. And all she did is get enraged. He showed me an email that she had written. You know, guys, this is how it goes. You just can't, most people just can't handle it. They can't handle the truth. They can't handle it. And so you've got to go through life either keeping quiet about what you know, or you got to have, you know, some tough armor on and not give a damn that what you know is going to wreck your whole life socially. You know, you're going to have a very small circle of friends. You might not have any friends, but like I always say, you know, if keeping friends means you got to be phony like them and play make-believe, they're not friends worth having. But it is the reality. You're probably not going to have any romance in your life. Women especially can't handle it. I mean, there are women out there, obviously, that care what's going on, that are truthers. But that's an exception, not the rule. Most women cannot handle. I mean, there's a lot of men that can't handle it either, but, you know, women are worse. They can't handle it. So, you know, it's not easy to attain or retain romance in your life. Many of you have already probably encountered that, unless the woman you're with already is aware. So, you know, maybe going to a truther conference is the only way to find a girlfriend. You got to use those as a pickup. Seriously. And if it isn't a problem initially, it'll probably become one later on in your relationship. You know, they're going to see that, oh, this guy is much more radical than I thought. You know, they just don't want to deal with it. They don't know. They want to live in a fantasy world. And again, I'm sure there's a lot of men that want to do that too, but percentage-wise, women are, you know, for the most part, they're more emotional. And they surely do get emotional. The truth is so radical, quote-unquote, to most people because it's so contrary to what they've been told. The deceptions are so powerful. They're so deeply rooted. It's too shocking. They just don't know what to do. And, you know, it's not that you're not making sense. You are making sense. That's the problem. What you say does make a hell of a lot more sense than what they've been told, and they just can't deal with that. They're going to have to change their whole life, the way they view the world. It's just too upsetting. It turns the whole life upside down. It's like the Bible dupe, you know, when they start hearing that, oh my God, this infallible book really is full of contradictions. This God really isn't that loving like I thought he was. He's actually a monster. They just can't deal with it. They freaking run in the other direction. They'll write you off. A friend of mine from college, I used to hear from him at least once a year. You know, we graduated in May of 2000. And at least once a year, you know, he would come out to see me, or on a few occasions I would fly out to visit him wherever he was living at the time. He was floating all over the place. But if not meeting up physically, you know, if that wasn't possible for whatever reason, he would at least call me or me him, you know. But usually it was more him calling me because he was always on the move, and I would go to call him, and whoop, his number's out of, you know, out of service. He's not living there anymore. This was, you know, before we got a cell phone. Now he's got a cell phone, but I don't bother calling him anymore because he's obviously blacklisting me now. The last time we talked was in 2011. And you can bet I'll never hear from him again. 4 years ago was the last time I heard from him. And I wasn't intending to bring this up. He brought it up. And since he did, I wasn't going to lie. I wasn't going to ignore the question. He asked me straight out, "So how are you doing spiritually?" Which means, you know, are you still a Bible dupe like me? So I, you know, I wasn't going to lie. I told him. I said, "Well, to be honest, Joe," I says, "no, I, you know, not anymore." And of course he was shocked. "What do you mean? You don't believe you, I know you're not a you know an Adventist anymore. You don't go to church." I says, No. It's way beyond that now." I said, "Joe, you know, it's like a lot of other things, politics, it's the same way with religion. The more you dig, the worse it gets. The more you discover that, wow, this thing is so full of crap, it's far beyond anything I had previously imagined. So it is with the Bible. So it is with, you know, religion. It wasn't just that organized religion is corrupt, as I started looking into the Bible with a critical eye." Anyway, I shared with him some of my findings. I hit him really hard, not arguing. There was no emotion, and I was just sharing with him, you know, my findings, but I hit him with some really hard stuff that he could not argue. In fact, he didn't say a word. Him and his wife both were just sitting there. I think I gave them the shock of their lives. They didn't offer any refutation. They were just pale in the face. And so, guess what? I never heard from him again. Never. He would, again, at least once a year, he would call and make plans to at least, if we didn't get together, you know, that year, he would make plans for the following year. "Hey, next year I'm going to be, you know, in Boston or something. Let's meet up," whatever, you know. Never heard from him again after that. And you know what? I guarantee I never will again. Never will again. For all I know, too, he's probably looked me up. He knows, you know, that I was doing a radio show. He's probably looked up and heard some of the topics, and they can't deal with it, just can't handle it. They love that word truth. They toss it around all the time. But to them, truth means what they have always been told is truth. When they're finally confronted with real truth, that totally conflicts with what they've been told is truth, they have to run the other direction. You got to love it too, because again, these people profess to be filled with love. They love the word love. They use it all the time. But look how it plays out. Look at the phoniness. Look at the goddamn hypocrisy. Oh, I can't hate it any more than I do now. I have a seething hatred for goddamn religion. Look how frigged up it is. It ruins friendships. It ruins marriages, families. It ruins lives, period. Even if you're not in a marriage relationship, it doesn't matter. It ruins your life if you're a frickin' hermit. God damn the whole frickin' mess. But anyway, and you know what amazes me is this guy, this, you know, former friend of mine, college buddy, he was a theology major too. He admitted to me that, you know, he was fed up with the corruption. In fact, he left the quote ministry. He did it for a while, a couple, I don't know, 2-3 years. And he left. He went into another field. He realized the whole damn thing was corrupt. Now, you know, it didn't stop him from going to church. He was still a church mouse or whatever. But he agreed with a lot of the things I said. He agreed with my findings on the Trinity, which is pretty amazing because that made him a heretic. But he realized to survive in the system so he could still comfortably go, you know, every week to church, he never told anybody. To this day, he has never shared with anybody that he's not a Trinitarian, which brings me back to the point I was just saying a few minutes ago about, you know, when you find out the truth, you either got to keep it to yourself, or if you open your mouth and share it, you got to be able, you know, to handle the fact that you're probably not going to have a hell of a lot of friends anymore. You're probably not going to have any romance in your life either, unless you find somebody of, you know, the same mindset, which is pretty goddamn difficult today, isn't it? Man, oh freaking man. Such is the blight of the truth error. Such is the curse of having a brain that thinks and wants to share what is found once you do that thinking. Obviously, it works that way in politics or, you know, in religion, in the media, in the educational establishment. If you want to go anywhere, you have to be, quote, politically correct, i.e. you got to be a mindless mushball, not think, or if you do think, never talk about it. Keep your mouth shut, be phony like everybody else, and your way through frickin' life. But it doesn't just work that way in officialdom, in official circles, in your professional life. No, it works that way in your everyday goddamn life, in your social life. It works the same way. Gotta play the politically correct game. Gotta keep your mouth shut. Why do you think people always say the two things you never talk about is politics and religion? The holidays are coming up next week. If you plan to go to a family gathering, you know damn well you got to keep your friggin' mouth shut. You can't talk to people that are supposed to be the closest to you, the ones that you should be able more than anybody else to open up to, right? No, those are the least ones you can talk to, the least ones who will listen to you, your own family. Got to keep your mouth shut. It'll stir up the pot. It'll wreck everybody's Christmas. Got to keep your mouth shut. You're feeling like a dam ready to burst, but you can't say a word because, oh, you'll upset them. Don't want to ruffle any feathers now. Don't want to upset their cozy little nest. Just talk about sports and the latest movie you saw, blah, 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 blah. Oh, I can't frickin' stand the whole goddamn thing. I can't stand it. I'm not looking forward to next week. I don't even know if I'm going to go to the family BS gatherings. I like a lot of the people that go, don't get me wrong. Friends and some, you know, obviously my family member. But I can't stand listening to the conversations, especially at this time where, you know, as was the case at Thanksgiving, they're going to bring up, oh, the upcoming election. They're going to talk about, I almost violated G rating there. They're going to be talking about frickin' goddamn Trump and Hillary and, man. People still, they're just not getting it, man. I can't believe it. There's such a complete disconnect, man, just complete cognitive dissonance among people today. They just are so out to lunch. How in the hell can you not see that these bastards and bitches are human refuse? the dregs, the bottom dregs of society, the scum of the earth. These people are treasonous, traitorous, frickin' trash. And yet they talk about them like, you know, anything they say has any significance, like they have any hint of sincerity in them. God damn it, man. Nothing could be further from the truth. I'm sounding like the Scrooge here, but I'm sorry, folks. I hate the holidays. God damn it, I hate them. Not just for religious reasons, you know, the whole thing being a fraud. No, it's just the phoniness of people, the having to get together with a bunch of BSers that chit-chat about frickin' nonsense and you know, the phony airs they put on. Just like, you know, if you ever go to a steepled corporation, everybody's so pleasant. They're so nice. They're a-holes the rest of the week, but they put on their Sunday best, and they smile so pretty and act like they're such loving people. Ah, knock it off. Shove the whole thing up your arse. Oh, I can't stand it. The phoniness of it all. Jesus Christ almighty. Don't you wish people could be like they are when you go to a cocktail party and everybody is loopy? Oh, they're real friendly then, aren't they? You almost wish everybody could be drunk all the time. That seems to be the only time that, you know, they'll let their hair down and actually be calm and relaxed. And you'll see some sincerity come out. People will actually apologize. You know, I guess I'm kind of a jerk sometimes, aren't I? I'm sorry. I don't mean to be. It'll make your jaw drop. And you'll think, wow, maybe this person isn't so bad. But the next day, they're sobered up and, I was pretty messed up the other night. I must have said some crazy stuff, huh? And it's back to business as usual. They're back to being a-holes again. But if you could only get them to be that way all the time, we should encourage people to become alcoholics. It seems to be the only way you can get them to be decent. God damn. You see what this society does to people? It, especially, you know, in areas where there's a lot of big businesses. I suppose Massachusetts is probably one of the worst for that. Where people are, you know, under a lot of pressure, the hustle and bustle, the pace of life is much, you know, much faster. It's much more stressful than it is in other parts of the country. I think New England is probably the worst for that. People are just a-holes up here. Just on a grand scale, man. It's snobby, totally inconsiderate of others. They just don't care. It's every man for himself. Even the way they drive, Massachusetts is known for having some of the worst drivers. They frickin' pull out in front of you. They don't care. They cut you off. I'm surprised we don't have road rage here like you do in, California. That's why our insurance rates are so high here. There's so many accidents. People just, my God, the way they drive is a reflection on just their general attitude. They're that way across the board. It's just, man, oh, man, oh, man. I got to get the hell out of New England eventually, folks. I'm done with it. Not to mention the weather, too. Of course, lately it's been really nice, but I'm just not looking forward. You know it's going to come eventually. That's what happened last year. It was nice up until late January, like the last week of January. All of a sudden, boom! The snow came, and it didn't stop until the end of March. Non-stop, every goddamn day just about it. I'm not looking forward to that frickin' crap. But anyway, you know, as time goes on, I'm getting less and less reasons to want to live in New England. There's a-holes everywhere you go, but I don't think quite as bad as up here. Jesus, man. But, a lot of that is a reflection on just this frickin' tribal-run, screwed-up country of ours. Look what it does to people. Their focus is on money, so-called getting ahead, the pressures of taking some extra classes so you can climb up the ladder while you're working 40, 50, 60 hours a week, if you even have a job. But everything is around, climbing the ladder. That's your whole life. That's all that matters to people. That's all there is, really. Their every waking moment is their job. A job that will most likely piss them out in any given moment. When they're done using you, they get what they want from you. Not like years ago, where, the more you applied yourself, the more a company wanted to keep you and would reward you with bonuses and raises. And, you had that job for life. Oh, Christ, not anymore. Now, people apply themselves and bust their ass just so they can stay there, not to get ahead, get a raise, get a, a bonus. No, those days are gone. They're hoping that they'll keep them, but of course, it doesn't matter. You can bust your ass all you want, and they're still going to piss you out whenever they damn well feel like it, without batting an eyelash. So, look at the kind of stress. Just that factor alone has screwed people up. The stress people are under, they make your life such that you really are a slave without chains. Well, that's one of the main reasons why people are such a-holes in New England. The pace of life here is so fast. The demands are so high. I'm sick of it. I want to move out to the goddamn country, away from all this frickin' mess, eventually. Get the hell away from all this. God damn it, man. Go live with the squirrels and the rabbits, the more sane creatures on this planet. Then you won't have to worry about, people attacking you for telling the truth. I think squirrels and rabbits, if they could talk, would be able to handle the truth a lot better than most goddamn people today. They probably already know it. There's those series of cartoons where this little girl is making a wish. I wish I could talk to animals. Did you ever see those? There's quite a few of them. Or I wish I could talk to my donkey or whatever. And so the donkey in the next segment of the cartoon, the donkey's telling her, I don't know, there's all kinds of different ones, but this one I got the other day, he's leaning over and saying, hey, jet fuel doesn't melt steel, kid. If animals could talk, I think it would probably be something along that line. Animals that live out in the wild, who live every day with predators pursuing them. They know how the world works. They're not trusting. They won't let you near them. Can't just go up and pat a wild animal. They're naturally paranoid, if you will. Paranoid isn't even the word, folks. They're naturally, aware of how the world works. They run because they know the law of the jungle is so pervasive. They know that most likely something reaching out to touch them is trying to catch them and eat them. That is how this world works. It works out in the literal jungle, and it works out in the concrete jungle, too. It works in the animal kingdom. It works in the human kingdom. It's just you can't get most frickin' humans, or what are supposed to be humans, to realize that. Anyway, I'm really rambling today. Jesus. Let me get back into the notes here. I haven't even been checking the call-in screen. Nope, no calls. All right, anyways, let's pick up what we left off yesterday. Jesus, I'm more than a half an hour into this show. Today is gripe day, I guess. But what a frigged up world. Look what it's done to people. Not only has this tribe frigged up our economy, frigged up our government, frigged up the media, frigged up the education system, frigged up the business world, frigged up this, frigged up that. They've just frigged everything up, but they've also frigged people up. Turned them into mindless, spineless, careless a-holes, for the most part. It used to be most people were decent. The a-holes were the exception. No, it's the other way around now. the other way around. I've pretty much given up on the dating scene. Yeah, I've dated so many women over the past, 8, 9 years since my divorce. Some of them lasted several years, others several days. I've pretty much given up. I'm on a hiatus right now from the dating scene. I don't even give a damn anymore. I really don't. I really don't. And you know what? I'm saving a lot of money too. Frig the whole goddamn mess. You know, sometimes they say, if you stop looking, that's when you'll find what you want. You know, it'll come to you. If you look too hard, you won't find it. Well, maybe that'll play out for me. I don't know. But truthfully, at this point, I don't even know if I want one. Even if one drops in my lap, I don't even know if I want a girlfriend anymore. The hassle of it, the stress, I don't know. I don't even know if it's worth it anymore. Maybe I'll move to Vegas and just rent a hooker out every once in a while. Jesus Christ, man. I'm just so fed up with the whole goddamn mess. I'm done. I'm done with it. This is the first time I've done this in the past, 8, 9 years, whatever. I've always had a girlfriend or been pursuing one, when I'd have a breakup after a few days or weeks or months, however long it took for me to recover, I was always back out there, up and running and, got the gloves on and ready to try it again, This time, no, I really, it's been months. I have a few women friends I still hang out with and I'm really close to, but I mean, I actually having a quote girlfriend. No. It's been over half a year now. I don't even care. I really don't. I'm just so fed up with the whole freaking thing. And it's just a sign of how degraded our world is. There's women used to be known for being compassionate. More so than men, compassionate, caring. You don't see it anymore, at least not here in New England, for the most part. There are exceptions, of course, but for the most part, I do not see women as being caring, compassionate. No, not anymore. They're very selfish, and I'm sure a lot of men are too, but you don't get to know a person until you date them. And since I don't date men and never will, I'll never know a man like, I know women. So I'm sure if you ask women from around my area, they'd say the same thing about men, too. But I can tell you, folks, the selection here is just horrendous. It's freaking horrible. Women are not compassionate for the most part anymore. The exceptions to that are far and few in between. They don't have that natural motherly instinct like they used to. Even with their kids, I see them all the time in malls yelling at them and, swearing. And my God, where is that? I remember seeing it growing up all the time. Women were soft-spoken. It was unheard of for a woman to swear, Even men, for the most part, didn't swear. It was considered offensive, and, I swear, too, but it's just that, society has completely changed. People are so, so different. Years ago, just a few decades ago, people protested. They didn't trust the government. They were fed up with us getting lied into war after war. Where's all that gone? What has happened? Look at this society. People are content today as long as there's a beer in the fridge. And a bottle of Prozac on the on the shelf in the vanity in the bathroom there. It's pathetic. Anyways, all right, get back to the notes here. In January of 1943, Roosevelt met with Churchill and Stalin at Casablanca to plan a strategy supposedly designed to end World War II. But the reality was, this conference was designed to drag hostilities out even longer. Um, their decision was that the war would end as long as Japan and Germany agreed to a, quote, unconditional surrender, something that they knew neither country would ever do, nor would any nation's leaders, with rational minds. This is kind of like the Rambouillet Accords, you know. They wanted to take control of that region. And so they figured, you know, we'll either get them to agree to the Rambouillet Accords, which they knew they wouldn't. Who would? What nation's leaders that weren't sellouts, that were loyal to their country, what nation's leaders would ever agree to that goddamn slop? You're going to allow NATO troops to come in and be exempt from any liabilities, let them do as they please with whom they please or whatever they please, whenever they please. Get the hell out of here. They were set up, ladies and gentlemen, so that no matter what happened, whether you surrendered or not, whether you allowed us to do whatever we want in your country or not, we're going to do it anyway. So look at the options they had, the Serbian parliament. Well, we might as well say no and have some dignity about us as they bomb us into oblivion, rather than agree to it and have our country destroyed and not have any sense of dignity about it. You know, they're going to rape and pillage us anyway. Kind of like the psychopathic rapist who's waving a gun at a woman is going to rape her. He's going to kill you anyway, so why not resist? You know, maybe you can take the bastard out in the process. Kick him in the nuts, kick him in the face, and then take your high heels and jam him in his frickin' eye sockets. Kill the bastard. Why not take the chance? That, you know, that was the Serbian parliament's attitude. We're not going to let you willingly destroy our country. We're going to resist you. We're going to go down like real men. Those days are gone, though, aren't they? Where's that spirit, you know, of resistance anymore? It's gone, man. It's freaking gone. Anyway, so we see the same thing, you know, having gone on here with Casablanca. They knew that by putting these demands on Germany, on Japan, unconditional surrender. Think about it. This was designed to ensure that hostilities continued, or if they didn't, if they gave in to those demands, well, that's fine. Either way, we're going to get what we want, total control of these countries. And that's just what wound up happening, isn't it? Not because they gave in to those demands, but because they bombed them into oblivion and still wound up going in. They went down like real men, in other words. Unfortunately, though, look what's become of them now, Germany particularly. God damn it, look at Germany, folks. Look what happened to that country. Absolutely decimated. Today, it's still decimated. Even though the country has been rebuilt from all the bombing raids, it is still decimated. Reduced to abject servitude. Oh, is it disgusting. A once proud, great country, independent country. Look at them now. Christ, they're not even a shadow of their former glory. So completely pussified that they're trembling in fear. My God, we don't even dare question the SOBs that have taken control of our country. We'll go to jail. We don't even question the Holocaust myth. We'll go to jail for 2 years. Oh, is it disgusting. A country that once led the pack in exposing those tribal bastards and their exploits. Now, forget resistance. They don't even open their mouths. And we're pretty much that way in this country too, aren't we? Anyway, military historian J.F.C. Fuller tells us exactly why the terms of the Casablanca meeting could never have been accepted. He wrote, first, that because no great power could with dignity or honor to itself, its history, its people, and their posterity comply with them, with those demands. This historian knew exactly what the Casablanca meeting was all about. He knew the setup that was underway here. The war must be fought, he said, to the point of annihilation. Just like, again, the Serbian parliament with the demands of the Rambouillet Accords. The same thing. No, we're not going to give in to that. If we're going to go down, we're going to go down like real men with a sense of dignity, with a sense of pride. We're not going to willfully hand over our nation. We're going to be wrecked anyway, far surpass our military strength. We're going to lose anyway. But why give ourselves over to them willingly? Absolutely, I totally agree. Anyway, the quote continues, secondly, once victory had been won, the balance of power within Europe and between European nations would be irrevocably smashed. Russia would be left the greatest military power in Europe and therefore would dominate Europe. Consequently, the peace these words of the Casablanca Conference, the peace these words predicted was the replacement of Nazi tyranny by an even more barbaric despotism. Well, Nazi tyranny, whatever. But nevertheless, a very true quote as far as, you know, recognition of the situation that the Casablanca Agreement posed to Germany and Japan. None of them were going to give into that. It was a setup designed to look on the surface like it was an attempt to settle the whole war issue at the bargaining table. See, we're rational, we're reasonable people. They're belligerent. They're the ones that didn't want to go along with the peaceful terms you were trying to work out. And the public falls for this crap every frickin' time. And it's not like it's hard to see through this. I mean, all you got to do is look at it. But people don't. That's the problem. They don't. They don't. I mean, they can create laws such that the wording is so obvious, even to the dumbest of the dumb, if people would just take a moment. But notice how they've gotten so crafty at this over the years. They know people don't read anyway. And, in the past, laws were only a paragraph or two. It didn't take long to see through it. But as time has gone on, they realize, it'll be better off if we create this massive piece of legislation that's 1,500, 2,000, 3,000 pages long. People will never find it hidden. And that's how it works. The real crux of any frickin' bill that they have up for vote, folks, is hidden deep within thousands of pages. It's always there. The real agenda is always there. Sometimes very subtle, but it's always there. But they know that people aren't going to pay attention. People aren't going to sit down and read all that crap. They don't even suspect that there's anything to be found there anyway. And you know what? Most people could actually undertake the endeavor of reading thousands of pages of any given bill, and they wouldn't even see the real agenda hidden there anyway, because they're not looking for it. You know what I'm saying? It's like the Bible dupe. People read that book all their lives and yet never realize the outrageous ridiculousness of the goddamn thing. They never see the contradictions because they're not looking for them. That's what's so sad. People could see what a fraud our whole legal system is, all the legislation, that comes out, they could see what a scam it is. But if they're not looking for the clues to clue them into the fact that, the whole thing is a scam, they're not going to see it. They're not going to goddamn notice it. And this is why they don't even hide their shenanigans. They don't need to. The stuff they do, it's it's done right out in the open, hidden in plain sight, as they say. It's right there in your face. They don't have to hide it because they know people aren't going to see it because they're not looking for it. Anyway, the Casablanca so-called peace conference was designed to drag on the war for many reasons. For one thing, they wanted to completely dominate Japan and Germany either by consent or conquest. And so realizing that they wouldn't give in to these terms, well, that'll give us the perfect excuse we need to keep the war on. But of course, they wanted to keep the war on anyway, as is the case with any military engagement we've been involved in over the years, because it's big money. That's why. Big money. Every war we fought, folks, measures have always been taken to ensure the maximization of profit simply by dragging the goddamn thing out. Both in Korea and Vietnam, for example, Washington was actually telling opposition forces, what our troop movements were. They were telling them in advance what our troop placements were going to be. You know, there were generals that were aware of this. MacArthur, for example, went on record expressing his disgust. He knew he could have ended that goddamn Korean War in just a couple of weeks. They fired him, in fact. He was going to leave anyway. They wouldn't allow him, these bureaucrats, these pencil-pushing pussies, who knew nothing about warfare and didn't care either. I'm sure he would have left in disgust anyway. He couldn't command the way he knew best. You know, that was his field. That's what he knew. He said, the orders you're giving will cost far more lives unnecessarily. God damn it all, man. And so it was in Vietnam, the same frickin' thing. I did shows on both those wars a while back and cited several generals that, you know, went on record making that same complaint, but from both wars. They want to drag on conflicts because it's frickin' more money, that's why. And, of course, they love it that people are dying, too. It's a great frickin' way to reduce the population. Anyway, and another reason they wanted the war to drag on, they wanted the U.S., in the wake of the thing, to emerge as the military hero of World War II so that it could be used, as it was, with minimal protest around the world to enforce freedom and democracy in the post-World War as it battled communism. What a crock, man. What a frickin' crock. All the Cold War was, once again, was outright in-your-face goddamn imperialism. But they got away with it because they were saving the world from communism. That was the BS rhetoric being sold, and that's what most people bought. They still buy it. With all the hindsight we have now, all the government documents that have been released, personal testimonies of insiders, it doesn't matter. People still believe the Cold War rhetoric. They think it was real. They come out with movies all the time about that era, reinforcing the BS, and people are buying it. God damn it all, man. They just had two in the past few months. There was that one with Tom Hanks there. He played the lawyer that intervened on behalf of this Russian spy that they were going to kill. I forget the guy's name now, but, you know, he worked an arrangement out where they traded back for powers there was that movie a few months ago, and then now this latest one on I mentioned it yesterday, you know, the what the hell was it now? Oh, yeah, the HUAC committee, you know, the House Un-American Activities Committee. Anyway, I can't think of the name of the movie now. But, you know, that's two movies that have come out in the past 2 or 3 months or so on the Cold War, pushing the Cold War BS, the idea that communism wasn't such a bad thing after all. That's the message in both of those movies. Isn't that interesting that they're, you know, they're really pushing that theme right now? Are they prepping people for something? There's also been a lot of movies, in case you haven't noticed. There's another one coming out, too. I saw some previews the other day. On the religious theme, I don't ever remember seeing the theater pushing, you know, movies with, you know, Christian themes like that. Oh, there was one on, what the hell was that damn book? Heaven is for Real. Remember that one? That was, you know, earlier this year, I believe. And there's been several others over the past, you know, over the summer they had a couple more. There's another one now coming out. I forget the name of it. Oh, there was the War Room, too. That came out in the past month or so. About this Christian mother who, you know, had this room set aside that she would go to in their house and pray. And I never saw the damn thing, but, you know, the previews, that was the gist of it. And the miraculous things that happened over the years, because she would go to that room, that was the War Room, she called it, you know. And how God would intervene. I mean, there's been so many movies with this theme, pushing, you know, pushing Christianity specifically, and the power of faith, and, you know, how it's, you know, it's real. Heaven is for real. Since when does Hollywood push the Christian theme? Jew run Hollywood, ladies and gentlemen. Since when do they push that? There's something going on with that. There have been quite a few, and they're still coming out with them, quite a few movies coming out with that theme. Very strange. Anyway, let's see here. Let's look at FDR's treasonous letter of 1943. This is a good one. On February 20th, 1943, Roosevelt wrote an astonishing letter to his emissary, to Stalin, Zev Zabruski, which provides us with some key insights into the true nature of U.S.-Soviet relations that existed during the Cold War, which hadn't even begun yet, but, you know, the stage was already being set at this point. They were already chumming up with the Soviets before the so-called Cold War even began. He also revealed the not-so-hidden power behind this sleazy wheeling and dealing. Here's some highlights of this letter. He said, "As I have already had the pleasure of telling you, I am deeply moved to hear that the National Council of Young Israel has been so extremely kind as to propose me as mediator with our common friend Stalin in these difficult moments." Jesus Christ, did you catch that? "The Council of Young Israel has been so extremely kind as to propose me as mediator with our common friend Stalin in these difficult moments, he said, when any menace of friction among the nations would have fatal consequences for all, but principally for the USSR itself. The United States and Great Britain are ready, without any reservations, to give the USSR absolute parity and voting rights in the future reorganization of the post-war world, referring, of course, to the coming creation of the frickin' UN, to give them voting rights. Look at this. God damn it, man. Our common mutual friend Stalin, the mass frickin' murderer, with at least 100 million deaths under his belt of his own people. He was a common friend of the tribe and the tribal whore in the White House. She, Russia, will therefore take part in the directing group in the heart of the councils of Europe and of Asia. She has a right to this, not only through her vast intercontinental situation, but above all, because of her magnificent struggle against Nazism, which will win the praise of history and civilization. Jesus frickin' goddamn Christ, man. I mean, I'm speechless. That doesn't even require any comment. Holy crap! Holy crap! Do understand, guys, that even the official history books admit that Stalin killed 100 frickin' million goddamn people, and yet he is being made out to look like the lesser of the evils, even when, again, officialdom only attributes 6 million lives in the so-called Holocaust, right? So let's give him that just for a moment. Let's pretend that those numbers are legit. Okay, Hitler killed 6 million. Against Stalin's 100 million? And yet Stalin is less evil than Hitler, according to, you know, their recollection of history. Oh God damn. Jesus Christ. Are you freaking kidding me? Look at the power of propaganda, ladies and gentlemen. Look how people are so freaking clueless. So freaking clueless. I've even seen some so-called truthers over the years who have tried to exonerate Stalin. Well, I guess he wasn't such a bad guy. They do it now with Putin, don't they? There's a lot of support for Putin in the truth movement. They sing the guy's praises. I'll be talking about him next. Stay tuned. What a raging piece of crap. What a fraud, man. Anyway, continuing with FDR's letter here, he went on to say, "It is our intention that I speak on behalf of our great country and of the mighty British Empire, that these continental councils be constituted by the whole of the independent states in each case with equitable proportional representation." God damn it, man. Russia is our buddy. Mass murderer Stalin is our good friend. And he wasn't even done. He went on to say, "And you can, my dear Zabruski, assure Stalin that the USSR will find herself on a footing of complete equality, having an equal voice with the United States and England in the direction of the said councils. Equally with England and the United States, she, Russia, will be a member of the High Tribunal, which will be created to resolve differences between the nations, and she will take part similarly and identically in the selection, preparation, armament, and command of the international forces, which, under the orders of the Continental Council, listen to this. My God, I mean, he's rolling out the red carpet here. He said, we'll keep watch within each state to see that peace is maintained in the spirit worthy of the League of Nations. United Nations wasn't even created yet here, and here he is talking about it. We're going to create another institution. That's one of the main reasons why we staged this war. We're going to create another institution in the likeness of the League of Nations. This one's going to succeed, and Russia, we're going to give you special concessions, our good buddies. Thus, these interstate entities, he said, are their associated and their associated armies will be able to impose their decisions and to make themselves obeyed. Holy Jesus Christ, man. Listen to the voice of tyranny there. He's talking about peace, but then in the same breath, our united forces are going to impose decisions made. We're going to make ourselves obeyed. Holy Christ, man. Stalin, he said, will still have a wide field for expansion in the, once again, guys, peace in that context. It's very obvious when you read between the lines. You don't have to even read between the lines. He comes out and says it. Peace means absence of all opposition. We will impose our decisions and make themselves obeyed. Make our decisions obeyed. Anyway, he goes on to say, Stalin will still have a wide field for expansion in the little unenlightened countries of Eastern Europe. In other words, we're going to let him, you know, we're going to divide up the turf. We're going to give him those Eastern Bloc countries for his little playthings. He will completely recover the territories which have temporarily been snatched from Great Russia. Unbelievable. They gave him those countries. The miseries that the Eastern Bloc countries suffered for decades on end after World War II were handed over to Stalin, ladies and gentlemen. Jesus frickin' Christ. I was very pleased at the gracious terms of the letter informing me of your decision, he said, and of the desire you expressed to offer me in the name of the National Council of Young Israel a copy of the greatest treasure of Israel, the scroll of the Torah. Jesus Christ Almighty. Look who was most instrumental in this whole goddamn thing. The National Council of Young Israel. Jesus Christ. You see, they already knew that Israel was going to be a reality in a few short years. So here they were calling themselves the National Council of Young Israel. And look how they were here influencing major political events at this key moment in history here with this fake war that they staged. Of course they were influencing decisions that were going to be, you know, implemented after the war. They implemented the war itself, God damn it. But can there be any doubt whose interests were being frickin' served here? When FDR was selling us out all during his long administration. Imagine if the bastard didn't die when he did and, you know, and carried out his full fourth term. For all we knew, he would have run for a fifth, sixth. What the hell else would that SOB have done? I mean, we were still sold out with every succeeding president, pretty much, but this guy here. This was tribal arse-kissing in high gear, man. Anyway, that concludes our FDR discussion. Let's look at Mr. Putin now. As I said, Putin is highly respected by many people, even people in the so-called truth movement. I'm really fed up with hearing about this. What the hell is going on here? People that should know better? Is this man really worthy of trust, of respect? Are you kidding me? The truth is, once again, guys, just on this basis alone, before you even look into this guy, who his supporters have been and what his real agenda is, the fact that the tribe hijacked Russia in 1917, they have always had control over that goddamn country. That's why they staged that revolution to begin with. And beginning right thereafter, they swooped down like a vulture on its prey and made sure that it would never slip out of their hands. They knew that Russia, like Germany, you know, had the potential to be a big problem for them and had been a big problem for them. They had to make sure it would never become a problem for them again. Do you really think now that somehow they're going to let that country loosen itself from their strangling grip? Never mind the collapse of the Iron Curtain. Come on, get frickin' real. Who was the one most instrumental in bringing that about? Mr. Gorby, Mr. High-ranking Freemason, pro-New World Order whore Gorby. So out the window with the goddamn perestroika and glasnost propaganda. That's all it was. Christ's sakes. Kind of like the same PR window dressing change that you got with Vatican II. What a freaking joke. The people that fall for this, man, are you kidding me? All that changed is the window dressing, the rhetoric. Beneath the surface, it's the same money-grubbing, power-hungry monstrosity it's always been. The same thing with the Iron Curtain. Give me a goddamn break. All window dressing. Look at the Russian people today, guys. Their economy is a frickin' sick joke, like ours. Are the Russian people any better off? There's still a tremendous degree of media control. I've said before how you can get more truth out of Pravda than you can with our newspapers. Yeah, about what's going on here. But as far as people being informed in the Russian media about what's going on in Russia, who the hell do you think controls? And if you're not aware, stick around. You're going to see who controls it. The same tribe, ladies and gentlemen, that controls our media here has a death grip on Russia's media over there as well. But again, before you even look at Putin, his background, his, you know, how he climbed the rungs of the ladder, before you even look at that, just on the basis of, you know, knowing what happened to this country in 1917, who was behind it, that alone should tell you this guy by default has got to be a fraud. He's got to be one of their puppets. They wouldn't allow it to be otherwise. And if he wasn't, it wouldn't be long before they'd have his suicide or his plane crash arranged for him. Come on. That's how it works. But as it turns out, upon close inspection, bingo. There's tribal fingerprints all over the bastard. So let's look at his rise to power. By the end of the 1990s, as Yeltsin's health began to seriously deteriorate, Putin was able to climb the pinnacles of power and thus fill Yeltsin's shoes, with help, of course, from a very powerful Jewish-Russian businessman named Boris Berezovsky. There were others, too, but this was the key player right here. He was a Russian who obtained Israeli citizenship at age 47, the key supporter of Putin, Berezovsky. Putin was personally appointed as prime minister on August 9th, 1999, by Yeltsin. Anyway, that's an interesting date, too, by the way, August 9th, 1999. If you write it out as 8-9-99, you got three nines, right? Which, of course, inverted, come out to three sixes. Might not have any significance, but we know how they operate, don't we? They love to play these little numbers games. I would say it probably does have significance, great significance. But anyway, within a few weeks, you're going to love this one. Keep in mind, once again, August 9th, he was appointed by Yeltsin as prime minister. President Yeltsin exalted him to prime minister. Wait till you hear what his job was prior to that. But anyway, within a few weeks of being appointed prime minister, beginning on August 31st of 1999, a series of, can you guess? Are you ready for this? A series of devastating bomb attacks, terrorist attacks, broke out in the Moscow area, targeting mainly apartment buildings, killing hundreds and wounding hundreds more. These were devastating attacks. There were at least, about a half a dozen of them, all within just a few weeks, from late August into late September. And they targeted civilian locations, apartment buildings. Bombs were placed in the basements of these buildings, and the entire complex was blown to smithereens, literally killing hundreds at a time. The attacks were attributed to the Chechens. However, many in Russia suspected otherwise, that they were instead the work of the FSB, the modern version of the KGB. I would argue that's exactly what they were. In fact, there's a great deal of evidence to make that case. We'll be looking at some of that. Anyway, for example, it was later revealed the following year that an alleged foiled September bomb plot in the city of Ryazan was, in fact, nothing more than an FSB exercise. The plot was foiled because several residents said that they saw a car pull up to the rear of an apartment building and unload several sacks into the basement. The sacks, after the authorities were called, the sacks were later found to contain a powdery substance with wires sticking out and a timer attached. The building was thus quickly evacuated, and the impression was given that everyone was saved from another planned attack. This was all staged. You're not going to have a situation, guys, where a car is going to pull up in broad freaking daylight for people to see and have sacks unloaded, and then the car drives off. Knock it off. This is so in-your-face freaking fake. Do you see how this crap goes on all over the world? Intelligence agencies play these same games on their populaces all over the world. Well, naturally, because they're all run by the same goddamn swine bags. That's why. As Nikolai Patrushev, the new FSB chief, later admitted, quote, "Nothing was prevented in this terrorist attack." In other words, when the police come in and they evacuated the building, nothing was prevented, he said. "And I don't think it was very well done. It was a training exercise, and the bags contained sugar. There were no explosives." So you're going to tell me the police that came in and seized the, you know, they had the bomb squad come in, actually, and collected these bags. You're going to tell me that they didn't know that it was sugar? If they didn't know ahead of time, certainly in the course of investigating these bags, the bomb squad, they would have known. If not initially, they would have known later on that it was simply goddamn sugar. But this was never made known by the police, the bomb squad. It was the FSB chief himself that later admitted it, only because they were caught with their pants down. Word had leaked out, you know, that this was an FSB job. So instead of admitting that they staged it just to manipulate people and keep the fear alive and, you know, of terrorism, blah, 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 he made it out like, well, it was only sugar because it was just a drill. Why would you conduct a frickin' drill like that in the first place? He never gave an explanation. What the hell purpose would that have served? But in any case, it doesn't matter. The fact that the FSB chief admitted that at least this particular instance was staged by the FSB, well, yeah, from there, all you got to do is start asking some hard-hitting questions. How do we know that all these other real bomb plots weren't also the work of the FSB? Well, guess what? Guess what? Just prior to Putin being appointed prime minister by Yeltsin, guess what his job was, ladies and gentlemen? He was the head of the FSB. And guess what else? In the wake of the bombing attacks on September 23rd, 1999, a group of 24 governors, more than a quarter of all the governors in the Federation, wrote a letter to President Yeltsin asking him to yield power to Putin and make him president.
Comrade, in the wake of these recent terrorist attacks, we find it necessary to give power over to Mr. Putin, who can handle this situation more effectively than you, dearly respected Yeltsin. You have done a good job, but now your time is spent. You are in your ailing senior years. We need someone who is more young and strong.
Look what was going on with this whole goddamn mess. He had his buddies in the FSB stage these fake frickin' attacks, so he would look good as the hero. Oh, because he did flex his muscle. He went on a anti-terrorism campaign. He went into a fit of rage. Those damn Chechnyans. Look here how this served their purposes in many ways. It gave some, you know, political clout to Mr. Putin, but it also justified clamping down on the Chechnyans. Big crackdown. On that same day, Yeltsin issued a secret decree authorizing the army to resume combat in Chechnya. This decree was illegal because Russian law forbids the use of regular troops within the country's borders, the Russian equivalent of posse comitatus. The following day, Putin issued his own order authorizing Russian troops to engage in combat in Chechnya, echoing Yeltsin's decree, but this one was not classified. It was open, you know, it wasn't a secret order. This was done in spite of the fact that Russian law grants no authority of the prime minister over the military at all. The Russian president couldn't even do this the way it was done. But no such authority at all is given to the prime minister to do this. That same day, Putin made one of his first television appearances stating, quote, listen to this. Oh, does this sound familiar? We will hunt them, the terrorists. We will hunt them down. Wherever we find them, We will destroy them. Even if we find them in the toilet, we will rub them out in the outhouse. Listen to this guy. And of course, you can just imagine the Russian people, the ones that, you know, fell for this rhetoric, probably a great deal of them. You could imagine them cheering this on. Oh, Putin is our man. Rah, rah, freaking rah. He's going to save us from the terrorists. Remember Georgie boy after 9/11 going to Ground Zero with his little bullhorn? The same stunt. We're going to get you. Yeah, we're going to get you. Jesus Christ Almighty. It's the same goddamn thing. The same frickin' thing. And this was about the same time, too, as 9/11, wasn't it? Just, you know, like a year and a half. Well, 2 years. 2 years before 9/11. The same kind of crap, about the same time. Government-orchestrated terrorism. And El Presidente, or at least at this time he was the Prime Minister, using these fake attacks that he and his intelligence buddies orchestrated to justify a big power grab and to wage war on the fictitious enemy that was framed for the attacks. Jesus Christ, man, you can't miss it. You getting to see what a little monkey Putin is, ladies and gentlemen? Unlike Yeltsin, Putin was not talking about bringing the alleged terrorists to justice, nor was he expressing sympathy for the hundreds of victims of the attacks. He mentioned nothing about that. He simply said, we're going to get them. Yeah, we're going to get them. Ride them, ride them, ride them. Keep those horses rolling, however that song goes. Rawhide. Oh, he sounds like Mr. War Hero here. Teddy Roosevelt, same idea. I'm surprised he didn't don a cowboy hat. Buy himself one of them there log cabins. God damn it, man. This is so trans-freaking-parent. Putin was talking like a dictator and acting like the president, even though, once again, he was not yet appointed or elected as such. We're not going to put up with it. We're going to get him. Who the hell was he to even say that? That should have been Yeltsin's job to say that, if it was going to be said at all. Yeltsin did mention, he must not have been in on this. He probably didn't have a freaking clue what was going on. He mentioned bringing them to justice, the terrorists. He expressed sympathy for the victims, not Mr. Rootin' Tootin' Putin. Classic false flag operations performed by Putin's FSB buddies on his behalf. And as you might guess, Putin's rhetoric had the desired effect. His popularity began to soar. Just like in America, they fall for the BS, the goddamn pageantry. That artificial patriotic fervor was whipped into high gear. In the meantime, Berezovsky went to work with his Channel One, demonizing Putin's political opponents while praising Putin as a hero, one who is tough on terrorism, and one who will bring about much-needed political reform. Once again, guys, Berezovsky is a hardcore frickin' Jew. And here he was with his control, his monopoly. This bastard was the one very early on, after the collapse of the Iron Curtain, whatever the hell that was supposed to mean, he was the one who played a key role in consolidating control of the media all across Russia. In Jewish hands, of course. Another major Jewish Putin supporter en route to the presidency was Alexander Goldfarb, who had been a dissident in the 1970s, a social activist in the 1960s, and he had served as, get this, George Soros' advisor on Russian matters. A major Putin supporter. God damn it, man. Anyway, still another major supporter of Putin's rise to power was the incredibly wealthy Russian Jewish media mogul, Mikhail Lessin. Doesn't that figure? Anyway, heavy pressure was put on Yeltsin by Putin's supporters to abdicate to Putin during his national address on New Year's Eve Day. This was believed to make Putin more likely to win the upcoming election, since he would, by that time, already be occupying the position of president anyway. So if they could get Putin to make him president before the upcoming election in a few months, you know, since he's already president, acting president, he'd be most likely able to win the election and officially be the elected president. Or, again, like they do here, all they wanted to do is create the illusion of support for him so that when they rigged the election, regardless how the people voted, you know, they could give the impression that the people did, in fact, vote for him. Anyway, sure enough, Yeltsin did just that, declaring in his national address on New Year's Eve Day, he didn't even wait till New Year's Eve itself, 12 hours earlier, around noontime, New Year's Eve Day, which is unheard of. Such a speech was always given on the, you know, right at, you know, near midnight, at or near midnight. He did this around noontime, early on, so that Putin, the new president, could be the one to give that New Year's Eve speech. Anyway, Yeltsin stated, "My friends, my dears, today is the last time I'm going to address you on New Year's Eve, but that is not all. Today is the last time I address you as president of Russia. I have made a decision. Today, on the last day of this century, I am going to resign. Russia should enter the new millennium with new politicians, new faces, new, smart, strong, energetic people. Why should I hang on to my seat for 6 more months when the country has a strong person who deserves to become president and to whom virtually every Russian has linked his hopes for the future?" He's really puffing up Putin here, isn't he? Yeltsin looked somber, fatigued, even depressed when he gave this speech. Maybe they threatened him. Maybe they even wrote the speech out for him. "Read this, or we're going to put cigarettes out on your testicles." Who knows? You know, at any rate, at midnight, sure enough, Putin delivered a short, only 3-minute speech in which he made no promises and said nothing that could be interpreted as being inspiring. Why should he? He already got what he wanted. He didn't want to make any promises that he would have to be committed to later. He didn't say nothing inspiring because there's nothing inspiring about him. He told his audience to raise their glasses and toast to Russia's new century, he called it. Yet, he had no glass in his hand to toast with. I think there was some deep symbolic meaning behind that. You can toast to what you think is something good. I'm not toasting to it, though, because it ain't going to be what you think it is. Putin was now acting president, and aren't they all acting? And the election campaign was officially underway, but there really was no competition at this point. with the tribal-controlled media praising him left and right, and all the rhetoric about being tough on terrorism, he was guaranteed a win. He wasn't worried. Just like Bush said, oh, I'm not going to lose. Over the next several months, leading up to the election on May 26th, the Russian people were relentlessly bombarded with pro-Putin propaganda in the Jew-controlled media. And sure enough, it paid off as he won the election with flying freaking colors. Let's look at Putin's troubled childhood and early adult life. This will tell us a lot about what makes the guy tick. He was known for constantly getting into fist fights with anyone who dared upset him in any way, which constantly got him in trouble at school. Viktor Borisenko, a classmate and longtime friend of Putin, said of him, quote, if anyone ever insulted him in any way, Volodya, or Putin, would immediately jump on the guy, scratch him, bite him, rip his hair out by the clump, do anything at all, never to allow anyone to humiliate him in any way. This guy had issues right from the beginning, ladies and gentlemen. Putin even said of himself, quote, I was a hooligan. I was a real thug. Doesn't that tell you a lot? Later, as a young adult, serving as an officer in the KGB earlier on, Putin carried on the same bullying tactics of his childhood. He was known for getting into a brawl over the least provocation. Usually such behavior would ruin a person's career in the KGB, but in Putin's case, an exception seems to have been made. It seems to help advance him. But anyway, with such a background, could we really expect that Putin would become anything but a thug in his adult life and in his political career? Can we really expect anything but corruption from him? Which is the whole reason why so many tribe members have supported this guy in his rise to power. Let's take a look at his first acts as president. This is very revealing as well. Judging from Putin's hooligan childhood and early adulthood, it's no surprise that he seized absolute power after the 2000 election was over. His first act as president was to grant immunity to Yeltsin from any prosecution. Does that sound familiar? Jesus Christ. His second act established a new Russian military doctrine, abandoning the old no-first-strike policy regarding nuclear weapons and emphasizing the right to use them against aggressors if, quote, other means of conflict resolution have been exhausted or deemed ineffective. In other words, he was fully intending to use, you know, nuclear weapons, quote unquote, if they even have such a thing. But in other words, you know, heightened military aggression at any country, at any time, a loose trigger finger president, in other words. Soon thereafter, another decree was issued establishing mandatory training exercises for reservists, something that had been abolished to the relief of Russian wives and mothers after the country withdrew from Afghanistan back in the 80s. Here he is now reintroducing that. This was a military man, ladies and gentlemen, obviously. Wanted to make Russia militaristic, which meant, and in fact has, you know, meant at the time, and that's how it's been played out in his administration, it meant inflated budgets and sucking the Russian people dry. to front the bill for all of this. Two of the six paragraphs of this decree were classified as secret, implying that he had plans of sending reservists to Chechnya, of course. A few days later, Putin issued an order granting 40 government ministers and other officials the right to classify information as secret in direct violation of the Constitution. Does that sound familiar? How many times have we seen that crap pulled here? Georgie Boy himself did it on numerous occasions. He also reestablished mandatory military training in secondary schools, both public and private, which had been abolished during Perestroika. He's bringing back...
Ah, the good old days of communism, comrades.
In all, six of the 11 decrees that Putin issued in his first 2 months as president concerned the military. His office also issued a plea for military spending to increase by 50%, when all the while Russia was unable to meet its debt obligations and was seeing its population sinking further and further into poverty. Does that sound familiar too? Massively inflating the military budget while yet the country is as a whole and as individuals, the Russian people, were suffering from economic depravity. Jesus Christ. Adding more economic burdens to them when they were already overtaxed, literally and figuratively as it was. Look what a scoundrelous bastard this guy is. And look who was supporting him. Can you expect otherwise? But once again, guys, on what basis is this guy getting praised by anybody, but especially within the so-called truth movement? Have you noticed there's a lot of praise heaped upon this guy? They're looking at him. I've seen a lot of articles. It's so disgusting. They've touted him as a champion, as a hero fighting against the New World Order. Oh, my God, I want to vomit. Not long after his inauguration, Putin began a campaign of sending his jackboots out to raid several media outlets that had previously been critical of him, such as MediaMost and the TV production company Ruskoye Video, raided their offices, again, under the guise of going after people that were delinquent in their taxes. Give me a break. How many times has this government done that? Sent out their frickin' IRS thugs. Oh, give me a break, man. Conducted primarily for what was claimed to have been tax evasion. Just harassing the media. The non-Putin-friendly media to keep their mouths shut. Some of these media outlets, in fact, the one I just mentioned, MediaMost, was run by a tribesman. How much you want to bet, though, that that was staged, that the tribe owner of it was in on it, and it was only intended to send a message to other smaller media outlets that were critical? You know, this is going to happen to you, too. I would bet my life on it that that's what was going on there. But anyway, the raids were conducted, as I said, you know, in the name of going after tax evaders. But the thugs conducting the raids were camouflaged outfits with black knit frickin' masks that had thin slits, you know, for eye holes. And they were all armed with short barrel automatic rifles. So this was, you know, police state tactics right here in your face.
Putin, the champion of human rights and decency and law and order, blah, 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 worthy of our respect. An enemy of the New World Order.
People are so goddamn clueless. And if they see one of their heroes in the truth movement make a claim like that, without even looking into it for themselves, they rally right behind that crap and, they get out their pom-poms and go on their cheerleading spree. God damn it, man. They want you to praise Mr. Putin. They want you to think that he's the hero against the New World Order. Oh, okay, so you're onto us? You're onto our New World Order scheme? You don't like it? Great. We're going to put our thugs out there that you could easily see we're supporting if you did your homework, but we know most people don't do that. There's even people in the truth movement that don't do their frickin' homework. They let their gurus do their thinking for them. Every bit as much as if they attended church every Sunday morning. Let their ministers do their thinking for them. Anyway, on May 30th, 2000, Putin proposed a set of bills, which were later passed, that served as the beginning of a profound restructuring of Russia's federal government powers, a return to the good old days of Stalin. One of the bills replaced elected members of the upper house of parliament with appointed ones. So getting away from the idea of elected members of the house, Putin and his thugs, we're going to appoint them now, not to be elected. Two from each of Russia's 89 regions, one appointed by the governor of the region and the other by the legislature, all his little handpicked puppets, of course. Another bill allowed elected governors to be removed from office on mere suspicion of wrongdoing without a court decision. Again, Putin taking it upon himself to be the one to decide who was going to be removed on mere suspicion. In other words, all that needed to be done was for Putin not to like you, for you to have said something or done something he didn't like, or for him just to be, suspicious, whatever, and boom, he's going to remove you. And then he's going to replace that elected official with one of his little appointed thugs. Look how he was restructuring the government to allow, a complete coup, revamping the entire system. And yet all the while this has been going on, the impression has been given, and even the Russians, a lot of them have bought this, that, Russia is becoming democratized, whatever the hell that's supposed to mean. But, it's becoming a more free and open society when this crap has been going on. Unbelievable, guys. Unbelievable. But again, don't we have the same thing here? We're told that we live in a free democracy. Yeah, right. And yet all the while, look at all the executive orders that have been passed over the years. Absolute dictatorial freaking power. Look at all the draconian legislation trashing the Constitution, the creation of entities like goddamn Homeland Security, passing the Patriot Act, Homeland Security Act, the John Warner Defense Authorization Act, the Military Commissions Act, on and 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 on.
Oh, but we live in a free, open society.
A democracy. Well, it actually is a democracy, and that's the friggin' problem. But, not a democracy in the sense of how people understand that word, wrongly understand it, to mean. They think democracy means an open, free society, and the people's will gets implemented. Yeah, right. That's not what a democracy is, ladies and gentlemen. Democracy is a goddamn dictatorship, a subtle dictatorship, where the masses are led, or should I say misled, into supporting whatever scumbag comes down the pike and supporting his agenda that they are manipulated into supporting through propaganda, and are led to think that their will is being accomplished and that what is being done is in their interest when it's not. That's what a democracy is. Not a government run by law, but by the manipulated will of the dumbass masses. Anyway, Putin also called for establishing 7 presidential envoys to 7 large territories of the country, each comprising about a dozen regions, each of which had its elected legislature and governor. So look at all the measures he was taking here to consolidate absolute control in his frickin' hands. The envoys, appointed by Putin himself, of course, would supervise the work of elected governors. So he was still allowing some governors to be elected, but their actions would be closely scrutinized to make sure that their seemingly independent activities were in conformance with Putin's wishes and his Jewish backers. God damn it, man. This amounts, of course, to dictatorial freaking power.
Oh, but no, Russia's a democracy now.
Yeah, it is, actually. That's the problem. Later, when Putin appointed the 7 envoys, only 2 of them were civilians, although one of them appears to have been an undercover frickin' intel agent. One of Putin's old buddies there. 2 were intel officers from Leningrad, 1 was a police general, and the last 2 were army generals who had commanded troops in Chechnya. So they're all thugs. Can you say frickin' police state? So really, only 1 of those 7 envoys was a civilian, not connected with the military or the police or intelligence. You can bet he was, he was under their thumb too, but he just happened to not have had that background, military or otherwise. Anyway, let's look at the re-election of Putin in 2012. In 2008, Dmitry Medvedev, as you may recall, was chosen over Putin as the new Russian president. But Putin was determined to regain the crown, and regain it he did. In the 2012 election, the billionaire Russian Jew, Mikhail Prokhorov, these are so hard to pronounce, simply because there's like 15 extra consonants in there that don't belong. Anyway, Prokhorov there, a Jew, was Putin's opposition or opponent in this election. But was he really opposed to Putin or sincerely contending with him, for the nation's highest political office? Of course not. It was all staged. He ran in order to ensure that Putin would get elected again. Because no one in Russia even liked him, and he knew it. They recognized that he was a corrupt scoundrel who, elite Jews in every other country, had been ripping them off on a massive scale with one financial scam after another. They couldn't stand him. He knew he wasn't going to win. He didn't care to win. His function, again, was simply to force people to want to vote for Putin by default because they didn't want him in bad. They wanted so badly to ensure that he didn't get elected, so Putin got it by default. What the Russian people didn't realize, unfortunately, and to a large degree still don't realize, is that the elite Jews in Russia, such as Prokhorov, absolutely love Putin. So in falling for that little shenanigan by voting for him, they were actually giving these tribal bastards that they were pissed off with and have been ever since for wrecking their country economically, that they're still supporting the tribe member by voting Putin. So really, it didn't matter if they had voted Prokhorov. It didn't make any goddamn bit of difference. By voting Putin, they may as well have gotten Prokhorov in there. The results are the same. Their country is sold out to the tribe, ladies and gentlemen. Putin is a tribal whore. No questions, no arguments about it. End of story. There's more that could be said on the matter. He engaged in a lot more outrageous, corrupt crap over the years that I could go into, but I didn't want to spend six shows on this. I just wanted to finally, hopefully, settle this matter once and for all. I've had several people, you know, ask me my opinion on Putin over the years, but I never got around to actually doing a show on him, so I figured now is the time, now more than ever, because there's just so much support for this guy in the so-called truth movement. I can't believe it. It's a scumbag. Anyways, so I hope that settles the matter once and for all on that bastard. All right, guys, have a great day. Got some interesting stuff coming up for you on tomorrow's show. Got two guests planned for next week, so that should be interesting. What's his name? McCaney there. He's going to be coming on talking about, well, all kinds of stuff. Some interesting science things, and some. We'll get into some politics, too. We'll be all over the map, I'm sure. He's on Tuesday, and then Wednesday, of course, the caller that called in yesterday, we're going to be talking about Sandy Hook. Some more new information that's come out. So that should be interesting. All right, guys. Have a great day. We'll catch you tomorrow. Take care.
Come to Dickie's Barbecue when you're ready to talk about catering. Whether it's a family reunion, a company picnic, or any type party. From little bitty parties to great big shindigs, our catering experts arrange everything, so you worry about nothing. We offer full-service catering, delivery buffets, even box lunches, with meat that's hand-rubbed, slow-smoked over real hickory wood in all of our stores every night. We may do your catering, but you're always our guest at Dickie's. If you love barbecue, come to Dickie's. We're a place that speaks your language.
Dickie's, we speak barbecue.